This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
And a very good afternoon to you. Today, Australia's peak body for truck drivers is launching a national campaign to try and stamp out an illegal courtesy signal that's been used by the haulage industry for decades. Also today, after the news headlines at 12:30, heading to the Claremont Showgrounds. It is that time of the year, the Perth Royal Show. It started on Saturday. Our reporter Kate Forrester is there this week. And today she's going to show you around some of the ag tech that's on display at the show, and also one of the really important awards announced just today at the showgrounds. This is the Ambassador, the Agricultural Ambassador for 2025. It's just been announced, so we'll meet the winner and the runner-up a little later this hour. 12:06 here on the Country Hour on the ABC, right across Western Australia. A farming community in Western Australia's southeastern grain-growing region celebrated its centenary over the weekend. Salmon Gums is 110 kilometres north of Esperance. Stan Stasevich is chair of the local development group which hosted the massive celebration, and he says even though their community is now much smaller than it used to be, it is still strong.
Nowhere near as many people, but we're still resilient. We've still got, I think you can see by the look of the town today and people turning out, we've still got a great strong community, which is what it's all about. Definitely still farming. The livestock has decreased in the last few years just with the lack of water, but we're more innovative. So farming's still strong.
We're about 110 kilometres north of Esperance. How important is it to still have services here in town?
Oh, definitely, hugely important. Salmon Gums at one stage was bigger than Esperance. There's quite a few famous Esperance businesses that all started in Salmon Gums originally. So, it's good to still have the services here because, we are 110 k's. We are used to driving up and down the highway, but it is nice to be able to come into town and just grab what you need, just a small thing. So,
Coming up, the crops looked magnificent this year.
She's not in the bin yet, but it is. We've sort of just clicked over an inch for September, which is an inch more than what we had last year. The weather has definitely been a lot milder this September. So, we're all optimistic, but then we're all well aware that, we are in Salmon Gums and it can change in an instant. So, but it's looking good.
Because for such, I suppose, a historic farming area, it is marginal.
Oh, it's very marginal, and talking to someone before, there was over 1,000 farms, 100 years ago. They were all 500 acre to 1,000 acre blocks and originally started at that size. So to have that many now to sort of 40, 50 farms, and everyone's obviously got bigger, but we're resilient, but it's great to have so many original founders have still got family here, like there's generations on. So it's something to be very proud of.
I'm Rod McRae, lived here all my life. I don't work, but I still live here. I got CP land of my own in about 1960. Got married in 63, so tomorrow is our 62nd wedding anniversary, and I've been here ever since. The sons have taken over our farm, so it's all good.
And as you say, your family's been farming in the region for over 100 years. Yeah. There must have been some big changes in that time.
Well, even one bloke I can think of, when he came to his farm, he was battling to find it. It was only a surveyor's track and a peg in the bush saying where his farm was. And they only had horses. There's maybe odd ones had tractors. But my father never got a tractor until about 1947, perhaps. So the clearing was done with axes and horses and rollers. And that was a terrible job. I can remember Burnside's out here actually clearing his first paddock out Sunrise Hill Road there with horses and a roller. And that was in the late 1940s, I guess.
Your family's been farming here for over a century. Salmon Gums is turning 100 this weekend. Yeah. What does the town mean for the farming community to have these services here?
When I was farming, it meant a terrible lot because, you know, we were 20 k's from the Gums, and most, unless you had a serious breakdown, most things you could get here at Salmon Gums, including stores. And it's just important to have things on hand and having people here in the school. If Salmon Gums wasn't here, Norseman would be our closest town to go to when you and kids to go to school. Yeah, no, it's important. And, yeah, it's good to see Salmon Gums is obviously thriving. And it's a credit to the people that have organised today that show off how good Salmon Gums is.
What does it take to keep a community like Salmon Gums alive and thriving?
I think being involved. I think there's a golf club. There used to be a tennis club. I don't think there is now, but most people used to play sport of some sort. And, well, like today, people have bogged in and set up all this. Well, if everyone sat back and said, no, buggy, it's not my job, there would be nothing. So it's just people become involved because they like doing what they're doing.
We've seen farming communities, the people who live in them, become less and less because the farmers have got bigger and bigger.
Yes.
But now we're seeing pressure on those big cities and towns because the cost of living is so high. Do you think we'd ever see people coming back into towns like Salmon Gums?
I think we're too isolated for that to happen. It'd be good if it did. But I can understand people moving out of cities and going to bigger rural towns where it's got all the major facilities, high schools and all that. I can see that happening.
What does Salmon Gums mean to you?
Well, I'm still here, so it must mean something. Just suits me in here and Iris.
Do you think Salmon Gums will still be here in another 100 years?
Oh, I hope so. Yeah, I can't for the life of me see why not. Well, you wouldn't know. But I hope so, yeah.
86-year-old Rod McRae, who officially opened the Salmon Gums 100th celebrations held on Saturday. Congratulations to the town. He was speaking to Tara de Langraft. 13 past 12. A new report has found there is systemic market failure in the chicken meat industry that without change could affect supply and consumer prices. Now, that's a significant concern because chicken makes up half the meat the average Australian eats. The interim findings on the state of the chicken meat industry have been prepared by ABARES, the federal government's commodity forecaster. ABARES executive director Jared Greenville says running a chicken farm is very different to any other livestock industry.
Most of us would consider, you know, standard agricultural industry where you have a farm, you own, say, your cattle, you grow them and then you sell them in the market or you sell them directly to Coles or Woolies or another producer, another abattoir. In the chicken industry, as a grower, you really own the sheds, your farm, but around that, the integrated producer owns the chicken the whole way through. They're responsible for the genetics, the hatching, they deliver your day-old chicks. They control the feed, the medicine, and so forth that's provided. And then they pick them up and they process them at the other end. So in a way, the growers are there providing that grow-out service for those integrated producers, the sheds and the way, and they add their management skill on keeping those chickens alive and getting them to market's best in that period of time.
Your report paints a really different picture depending on who you talk to. Integrated producers saying the relationships are strong and positive. There are no market failures or significant issues. The growers saying It's not functioning efficiently in large part to the actions of the larger players, integrated producers, and there's a fear of punitive measures and retribution for standing up for themselves. Can you go into some of the details of what you're finding in that relationship and the differences in it?
Yeah, that was a good kind of way to characterise it. There are these vastly different viewpoints across the industry participants around these arrangements, but we found, like, on balance, and we talked to growers across the country, both big and small, who represented a significant share of total production. And really they were saying that there's these issues that really stem from the concentrated nature of the market. And so a couple of integrated producers control about 70% of the supply of chicken in the country.
So that's more concentrated than supermarkets are in Australia, for example.
Yeah, that's right. That's more concentrated than supermarkets. And it's really driven by the ability to get economies of scale and to integrate these production processes. So there are some gains to that. But the flip side of that is that it creates the potential for, you know, we say bargaining power. And if that bargaining power is used in certain ways, then it can actually induce, you know, a certain amount of, I guess, inefficiency into the industry.
And a lot of that is around contracts and what's in these contracts. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So most often this manifests in the way that the contracts are written. And so it creates, you know, market risk. You might see a change in the risk that the integrated producers should really be what best placed to manage. And they're able to force that down onto growers through using certain contract terms like picking up chickens early, delaying the batches and all those kind of things. And we've found that in some instances, you know, even if you meet the contract specifications, that you can get paid a lower price than what you signed up to with a contract. And that makes it really difficult if you're a grower to kind of really understand that contract or to kind of manage what kind of income you would have. And also to really kind of obfuscate or make some of the dispute resolution when there's an issue, make that really work ineffectively.
And then that integrated company will have a say if the farmer can sell their property or not and to whom, yeah?
Yeah, and so this is the other element which we picked up with what we would kind of term barriers to exit, or, you know, in other industries, if you're a, you know, an employee yourself, you might have a non-compete clause where, you know, you're in an industry and then when you leave the job, you're not allowed to stay in that industry. And they're those similar kind of things that we were seeing that, you know, there's conditions on the sale of your property if you're a grower that might restrict your ability to move into other industries or restrict who you can sell. And those things are generally deemed uncompetitive. The end point, I guess, of all these, you know, various bits in contracts and the uncertainties that exist in them is that returns to growers is not enough for them to be viable or maintain a level of viability in the industry.
Chicken meat now makes up more than half the meat an Australian consumes. It's quadrupled since the mid-1980s, so in my lifetime. If things are so bad in the chicken industry, why is it selling so much product and continuing to sell more?
It's a good question, and I think one that we grappled with at the onset. It's been a gross industry, one where we've seen clear productivity gains, and one which is delivering a product that consumers want, and we see that through the consumption statistics. And I think the issue, I guess, is there's two parts. So this shift to this vertically integrated, this processes and producers and that scale is quite a good thing in terms of it's been able to deliver for consumers and the like. And it's just then when that scale and that concentration can lead to some inefficiencies. And I think we're kind of getting to that point now.
What are the options that you're looking at to try and rectify some of this market failure before it gets worse?
If the government or, you know, industry is going to do something about this, so there's always pros and cons and costs and benefits. And so we're keen to hear about, you know, industry views around the various and the efficacy of the different responses. Now, obviously, there's always the option to do nothing. And as you mentioned, you know, the industry has been growing and delivering, you know, a product that consumers want. But that brings with the continuation of the risks that we've just been talking about. The other aspects we think that are worth a look at are things like further consideration of unfair contract terms by the ACCC and what that might mean to help resource the ACCC to undertake that. A degree of industry self-regulation, so not for government, but for industry, the growers and the integrated producers to get together and come up with some of their own standards that they might want to apply in the industry and what that would look like to then other options, which we see in other agricultural industries, who have had, you know, similar issues in terms of concentration and where it goes. And they're the codes of conduct that exist within the Australian competition law. And so there's a prescribed voluntary code of conduct or a mandatory code of conduct.
Executive Director of ABARES, Jared Greenville, speaking to Warwick Long about the interim report that's out today and has found that there is systemic market failure in the chicken meat industry that without change could affect supply and consumer prices. Now, that interim report is available on ABARES' website and submissions close at 5 o'clock Eastern Time on Friday the 24th of October. And the final report is due to be handed to the government by the end of the year. 20 past 12.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Australia's peak body for truck drivers is launching a national campaign to try and stamp out an illegal courtesy signal that's been used by the haulage industry for decades. In the 1950s, truckers started using indicators to signal to drivers behind them that it was safe to overtake. But the Road Safety Authority is saying the practice is now fraught with danger. Heather Jones is a truck driver who runs her own truck driver training and heavy haulage company and says she's no stranger to the perils of trucking on regional roads.
Well, even a couple of years ago up in the Pilbara, there was a truck driver indicating to turn right, and a car and caravan thought he was indicating for them to come around, and they actually ended up running into him and dying. So the indicators are there for a reason. Let's just use it for the reason that they were designed for and stay safe. This is probably one of the worst times that we see on the highway as well, bad behaviour, and just slow down, just drop 10Ks.
Mark Parry heads the Australian Trucking Association and says there are much better ways for truckies to communicate with other road users.
The assumption that if someone puts their right indicator on, it's okay to overtake, isn't always correct. Sometimes a vehicle is simply signalling because there might be a mine road coming up or a farm road or whatever else. Many, if not all, truck drivers and many people towing caravans have UHF radio, and certainly using that communication is a far better way to go. Given that this has been raised and given that, you know, there's probably a history of some terrible accidents and incidents as a result of this, we will put out a safety brief because that's the sort of thing that we do for the industry.
Brad Morrell drives trucks in the Eastern Wheatbelt and says impatience is one of the biggest problems on the road, and that's dangerous at this time of year in the Wheatbelt.
Harvest particularly, we are flat out carting grain from producers' farms to CBH. Now, you know, I'll be travelling west on Grayson Highway and I'll be approaching Kellerberry and I'll approaching the turnoff or Steelwell Road to CBH Kellerberrin, and quite often there's a certain point where I'll back off the throttle and start indicating and start braking, and I try to give plenty of notice, but you'll always get cars that will try to come around you, and they take your sign, you know, your indication as a sign to come around, and I've been caught so many times about to turn the steering wheel right and nearly collected the bumper of a car racing past because they've taken my indicator as turning right as a form of passing. My parents went to South Australia last year on a caravanning trip, came back, and I just said to them, I said, make sure your two-way radio's on, make sure you're speaking to the truckies all the time, you listen to what the truckies have got to say, working with them with your two-way radio. Anyway, on the way home, Mum and Dad were coming back and they were slowing down on Great Eastern Highway at Barndee Lakes, and indicating to turn right, same thing again. He's just about to turn the steering wheel and someone just had to go past because I took it as an indication that Dad was saying come around. And Dad was scared. Dad's 80 years old. He was fearful for himself and Mum, but he was fearful for the other drivers on the road.
And you've had your own experience, you were saying, when you were younger of nearly getting cleaned up again. Can you tell me a little bit about that one?
Yeah, so as a kid, I was 18 years old, fresh out of school, 1992, and I was actually headed towards Kalgoorlie. I was going to go and work in the cattle station, sheep and cattle stations out of Leonora. And I had a mate of mine with me in the vehicle, and we were eastbound. And a mate of mine said to me, he goes, you come up behind a truck and they're indicating right, it means, you know, they're indicating for you to pass them because they're a slow-moving truck. And so I was inexperienced And so I said, yep, right, no worries. I'll take that on. Anyway, we came up behind a truck just after Barndee Lakes, and this truck was indicating right, and so I took it as a sign for me to go around. And as I was going around, he started to swing his steering wheel right, and I nearly collected his front bumper, and he nearly took me out. And it was pretty bloody scary, like, you know. And so ever since then, I have never, ever, ever indicated for anyone to come past me. Never. I understand why they do it. I understand they don't want to inconvenience other drivers. If you've got a slow-moving truck, it's a road train, he's heavy, he might be going up a hill, his speed's reduced from 90, 80, down to 70, there's people stuck behind him. If he's got a clear vision in front, then I understand why he's going to indicate people around. I get it. But we've got to get out of the habit, because there's other road users, other truck drivers on the road that we are indicating to turn off the highway. And it's not just Kellerberrin and Meriden. If you're on a highway, get out of the habit of indicating people around. People have to understand if we're indicating, we're actually going to turn off.
It's quite timely, isn't it, on this long weekend, this Monday public holiday, if you are heading home after a long weekend away. Truck driver Brad Morrell explaining to Anna Cox why he thinks it's no longer safe for anyone to use indicators to signal to drivers behind them that it's safe for them to pass. The Australian Trucking Association has announced it's going to run a national campaign about the dangers of signalling to overtake. You can read more on the story. Just search ABC Rural and Truck, and you'll find Anna's story on the ABC Rural website. 26 past 12, shortly checking in with the news headlines around about 12:30. Before we get there, though, a disease devastating mango orchards in the Northern Territory is now raising concerns among growers in the Kimberley. It's called mango twig tip dieback, which is a disease that spreads along mango twig branches and leaves and can sometimes kill the entire tree. Last year, mango twig tip dieback affected up to 90% of Kensington Pride orchards in the Darwin region, costing growers about $7 million. The disease hasn't found its way into Western Australia yet, but Kununurra grower Steve Angel is already taking steps to protect his crops.
Look, it's a big concern for everybody in the industry. At the moment, it's devastating Darwin. I've seen trees up in Darwin, and it just doesn't affect one tree. It affects a high percentage of trees in that orchard. And you stand there, and it's really visible when you see it. There's no hiding from it. It's just a disaster.
What does it look like?
It just looks like a tree that's got no leaves on it and all dead branches. It's as simple as that. We haven't got it here yet. It hasn't arrived in Katherine yet. But it's an airborne fungal disease the scientists have identified. And we just have very strict quarantine. And that's the only defence we've got. There's no silver bullet to curing it at this stage.
What are you doing to prevent this disease in your orchard?
We have our own quarantine thing here where we allow no foreign vehicles into the orchard. Anyone that comes from Darwin or any reps or whatever have to walk through a footbath. It's not the answer, but it's just preventive maintenance, and we just, you know, trying to stop it coming here. Whether we're successful or not, I don't know.
Are your methods to prevent the disease very expensive? Is it costing you a bit of money to put all this into action?
No, it's not costing us that much money, because we cut old drums in half and people just walk through them. Some people don't like walking through them with their nice new shoes, but that's our protocol. Any machinery that comes, like the pruning saws and everything, they have to be fully sterilised before we have them on farm.
Are you hearing from other growers that they're also concerned about dieback potentially hopping over the border into northern WA orchards?
Oh, yeah, look, there's always the potential for it. There's no doubting. You have truck movements, rep movements, you know, representatives from chemical and fertiliser companies. You have a great number of people moving around in the industry. And you also have a great number coming at harvest time and stuff like that. We have no real control, but we just take measures. Local growers would be concerned, put it this way, they'd be more aware of it now because it's in the news, it's in the Mango Association. It's a number one topic because there's no answers to it. Yeah, and that doesn't help.
Steve Angel, who runs WA's biggest mango farm on the outskirts of Kununurra. He was speaking about the precautions he's taking against mango twig tip dieback disease. Australian Mango Industry Association CEO Trevor Dunmull admits the disease is causing serious problems for Darwin farmers, but he doesn't think WA growers should be overly concerned.
Certainly it's a serious issue in the Darwin region, and Northern Territory Department are doing research on it and developing a research proposal to do further work over the next few years. The actual disease symptoms have been expressing since about 2017, and it looks like it's a combination of existing pathogens and an environmental impact that's having an effect on trees.
What kinds of stories have you heard from growers about how this disease has affected their yield and their crop?
In Darwin, it's a serious issue, especially some of the longer established orchards, and affecting both older trees and then where there's some replanted young trees, it's also affecting them. So there has been some research done in the past years, but it's certainly this research is ramping up. The reason we need the research is to make sure we better understand it and develop improved management practice so we can get on top of it so it doesn't become an issue in any other region.
What is the difference between the dieback that most or many people will have heard of and this mango twig tip dieback?
Symptoms are different, and common dieback, which you're referring to, can be seen in most regions in trees that are getting older. This twig tip dieback has different symptoms. The apical point of the growing tip starts to die back, and that usually, as I said, that usually happens as the dry season extends.
So is there a concern, do you think, that this could spread to other mango growing regions like in the Kimberley, WA?
No, because most regions have good biosecurity measures in place, and especially Western Australia has very sound biosecurity measures. So the movement of plant material into like the northern Western Australia is not happening.
Trevor Dunmull, he's the Chief Executive Officer of the Australian Mango Industry Association. The NT Department of Agriculture and Fisheries has identified two fungal species as the likely causes of this mango twig tip dieback, and it says there are strict controls on plant and fruit movement between the states and the territory. And WA's Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development says it's working with its NT counterparts to better understand and manage the impact of the disease. 28 to 1, Tony Carr is here with an update from the newsroom. Hello.
Good afternoon, Belinda. The Federal Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, says the government has responded appropriately to the Optus outages. The telecommunications company has confirmed a problem with a mobile phone tower in New South Wales on Sunday meant some callers couldn't get through to 000. It follows an outage across the country earlier this month that led to hundreds of failed 000 calls. A new body, independent of the federal government, will begin operating from today, aiming to prevent suicide among current and ex-serving Defence Force members. The Defence and Veterans Services Commission has been established as a result of a recommendation from the Royal Commission into Defence and Veterans Suicide, which released its findings a year ago. And US authorities say five people have died following a shooting at a Mormon church in Michigan, including the man suspected of carrying out the attack. Local and federal law enforcement allege that 40-year-old Thomas Sanford deliberately set fire to the church after ramming it with a vehicle and shooting at parishioners. Belinda, more news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you for the update, Tony. 27 to 1.
This is the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio, WA.
And shortly heading to the Claremont Showgrounds, the Perth Royal Show. It is on right now. Our reporter Kate Forrester is there. So she's going to show us around some of the ag tech that's on display there this year. For the first time, really, there's a new exhibition there showing some of the latest ag tech. And also one of the big awards handed out, the 2025 Rural Ambassador for WA Award has been announced, and you will meet her and the runner-up shortly here on the Country Hour. First, making our way to the Bureau of Meteorology, Caroline Crowe is with you this afternoon. Caroline, let's take a look across the Southwest Land Division, because just as we were getting used to some warmer temperatures, things changed over the weekend. How's it looking this afternoon?
Good afternoon, Belle. Yes, a ridge is pushing through in the Southwest Land Division, sitting sort of across from Perth, through Perth and east. So south of that ridge, still allowing some weak cold fronts to move through. So the cold front we experienced on the weekend, and being onshore airstream, still seeing some residual showers through southern districts. Coming into tomorrow, another weak cold front is going to scrape the south coast. So we'll still see those showers continue through southern coastal parts. Might see a light shower extend as far north as Perth, across through to Lake Grace and across to Balladonia. So south of that line, may see a light shower coming into at some stage tomorrow as that cold front moves through and east along the south coast. North of that area through the Southwest Land Division is generally going to be remaining generally clear or partly cloudy conditions. But as we move into Wednesday, the ridge moves a little bit further south, and we're going to see those showers gradually get confined to southern coastal parts and clear towards the east. So by Thursday, Bell, the ridge and a high will move over southeastern parts of the state, and we'll have easterly winds and throughout the Southwest Land Division, clear conditions, no rainfall expected on Thursday. We do start seeing a trough develop down the west coast, though, so a summer-like trough developing down the west coast on Thursday. So warmer temperatures will be dragged back down into the Southwest Land Division, mostly about those western parts, northern and western parts coming into Thursday. Now, the trough is pretty mobile, so it's moving inland on Friday already as we start getting a front approaching from the west. So those warmer temperatures will be dragged further east as well. So when I'm talking about those temperatures, looking through northern parts on Thursday, 4 to 8 degrees above average and 2 to 6 degrees above average through the southern parts. The hottest day for the west coastal districts will be on Thursday, getting into sort of the mid low 30s, Mullewa, Morowa, sort of 33 degrees, Mora, Cunderdon, that area there. Hyder is still going to be 30 degrees, and in the southwest corner we'll be getting up to sort of the mid 20s. For Friday, we'll see a little bit cooler temperatures along west coastal districts. However, we'll see those low to mid 30s getting into eastern parts of the Southwest Land Division. So Muckaburden's 34, Southern Cross 35, still getting to 30s around Cunderdon area, and then eastern parts, so Salmon Gums 37 degrees, Esperance 34 degrees. And along with the summer troughs that we get, we can get those fresh and gusty northerly winds ahead of the trough, which looks like it's going to be in this situation as well. So expect some gusty winds and fresh winds on Friday as that trough moves east, which also may bring on some elevated fire danger ratings through those eastern parts of the Southwest Land Division, Bell. The other thing over for the Southwest Land Division over the next couple of days is with the ridge just jumping back to tomorrow morning, minimum temperatures will be quite low. We'll see some below 3 degrees through those central parts of the Southwest Land Division. So frosts are possible tomorrow morning, and again, a smaller area, more in the inland southwest parts on Thursday as well.
All right, let's take a look into northern and eastern parts of the state.
So northern and eastern parts are generally sunny throughout the north and the east at the moment. As that ridge that I mentioned in the south just extends east a little bit, we will see a little bit of a southeasterly winds push up through into eastern parts of the Pilbara and interior from Wednesday through to Friday, and get into southern parts of the Kimberley for a period on Thursday, and possibly southwestern parts of the Kimberley on Friday. This surge isn't as strong or long-lived as the previous easterly surge that we had last week, which stayed on, hung around for quite a few days. Now, I mentioned that trough, so that heat is going to drag into the Gascoyne coming into Thursday, and those northerly winds or northeasterly winds east of the trough as well for the Gascoyne will freshen up from Thursday. So we could see some elevated fire danger ratings through the Gascoyne coming into Thursday, and as that trough becomes mobile and moves east and gets more into the Goldfields area and those freshening winds and warming temperatures as well, Goldfields area and southern coastal parts could see some elevated fire danger ratings as well. Also, just getting up into the north of the Kimberley, we've seen the odd shower develop through far northern parts over the last couple of days. So we still might see that odd shower. But coming into Friday, it looks as though we might get a couple of thunderstorms through northern and eastern parts of the Kimberley.
Thanks so much for going through those details. Appreciate that, Caroline. 20 minutes to one. Let's take a look at the rainfall figures over the weekend with Richard Hudson.
Yeah, so this is 9am Friday through to 9 o'clock this morning. No rain at all in the north and none in the eastern forecast districts either, but in the southwest land division, I suppose you could say it was a bit hit and miss. In the central west, Durian Bay topped it with 2 mils. In the lower west, Bickley 5, Bungendore 6, Gidgegan up 5, Carnet and Carrigulla North 6, and Rolly Stone had 7 mils. And then in the southwest, Beetle up 10, Manjum up and Margaret River 5, Millian up 7, Northcliffe 12, Quinnan up 7, Shannon 14, Windy Harbour 7, Yanmar 6, and then in the southern coastal area, Albany and Dalyup Park 11, Chain Beach 16, Denbarka 13 over 4 days, Denmark and Erinair 12, Esperance 14, King River 12, Many Peaks and Mount Barker 6 mils, Stirling South 7, Tamar 9, Tallina Downs 5, then in the central wheat belt, Mount Westdale topped it with 2 mils, and then in the Great Southern, Chaming Up had 5, and I think that was the top in the Great Southern, yeah.
And a big weekend for you, Richard, the grand final Saturday and yesterday off to the 2J races. What was that like?
Oh, it was a fantastic time. As you know, my job is to add a bit of class and elegance and panache to the catwalk for the fashions on the field, just to educate the punters on things like fascinating fascinators. And you could have learnt a thing or two if you'd come along, actually.
How did you get that gig?
Well, I mean, what I don't know about Coco Channel, it's not worth knowing, let me tell you. But on a serious note, at the start of the show, you mentioned 86-year-old Rod McRae from Salmon Gum saying, look, if everyone just sat back and said, bugger you, it's not my job, there'd be nothing. That sort of attitude was evident at the 2J races. That volunteer, chip-in attitude from some of the locals is why that race day was resurrected last year and why it was a great day yesterday and why it will thrive in the future, because everyone did chip in. It was a great effort from everyone and, yeah, ripper day and night.
I'm glad you had a good time, Richard. Judging those fashions in the field, I can only imagine. 18-1 here on the Country Hour. No markets today, obviously, with the public holiday, so we'll do the double-header tomorrow, the Mouchet cattle and sheep tomorrow, going through the yarding and the prices then. Let's head to the show now, because this is the annual celebration, really, of agriculture, food, community and entertainment. And it all kicked off in Perth on Saturday with the start of the Perth Royal Show at the Claremont Showgrounds. Our Royal reporter, Kate Forrester, is at the show for the Country Hour over the next couple of days, meeting all the people from all over the state. Kate, hello. What is the atmosphere like at the show today?
Hi, Belinda. Yes, I am at the Perth Royal Show today. It's the third day. So as you said, it did start on Saturday. And being a public holiday, I am looking around and there are so many people already. It's families, it's lots of young people, kids, there's all ages. It's really good to be here. The sun's out. When I walked in this morning, the gates hadn't opened yet, but there were already horses warming up in the main arena. The show bag stands were opening their doors. Actually, on that, there's already lines outside the show bag stands. But where I'm actually standing at the moment is outside a really new exhibit. It's the first year they're running here at the Royal Show, an exhibit called Smart Farms. And it's all about looking at how technology is changing on farm, and it's trying to get more kids on board with it. But instead of me going through and, you know, trying to describe to you what I'm looking at, I've actually got someone here with me who is the organiser behind this exhibit. Alaric, how are you going?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, really good. So tell me a little bit about yourself. Where are we standing at the moment and what have you done here?
So we're in the new Smart Farms Pavilion here at the Perth Royal Show. This is our new educational interactive display all about the future of farming and the technology and innovation that's used in farming today.
So why did this come about this year? Because it's the first year it's running.
So we have research that shows that the majority of people don't think rural industries have changed in the last 40 years. And so we did a bit of thinking and realised that we present agriculture at the show a lot of times in a way that hasn't changed in 40 years. So if we want to have people change their perceptions of agriculture, we need to change how we show agriculture here at the show.
Okay, so where we're standing at the moment is in this new exhibit. I'm looking around and it is pretty cool, if I'm going to be honest. There's drones on display. I think there's a vertical farming over there. Tell me, what is on display here?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different zones and a lot of different areas here in the Smart Farms Pavilion. We've got everything from drones, plant science, ag bots and vertical farming, and even a little colouring in that comes to life on the big screen that's really been popular for the young kids.
So this is targeted at a younger generation, really?
It's targeted more at the younger generation, but there's definitely enough here for anyone that's interested in agriculture, careers in agriculture, or what agriculture looks like today.
Yeah, okay. Should we do a little bit of a walkthrough and see what we can find? So if we come over to this screen over here, kids are drawing on a piece of paper. What are they drawing and where does it go?
Yeah, so they get to select between one of four of a technology that's used in farms, a bit of machinery. So it's anything from a satellite doing a survey to a tractor on the ground. They get to colour those in, take it to our scanning station, and then they get to see that come to life on our big video wall and go across the field spraying the crops or ploughing the field or whatever it might be.
And maybe one of these designs are the future of farming. You never know, it could start on this screen and then actually end up in the paddock.
Yeah, it's getting young kids interested in design, interested in ag, seeing what the possibilities are and seeing what different types of machines that we use in a really simple and fun way.
And we're standing, well, actually, we're standing in the way of everyone walking through. So it's obviously had some really good turnout. And have you had good feedback about the exhibit?
Yeah, it's proving to be one of the most popular pavilions that we've got here at the show. There's been a lot of people coming through, really engaging and really exciting and learning about things that they didn't know about, didn't even know they didn't know about, and learning in a way that they don't necessarily realise they're learning. They're just getting involved and then picking up those key messages along the way.
So this is the first year it's running. Are you hoping that this kind of becomes a regular exhibit here at the show?
Yeah, so we're looking at a 2 to 3 year lifespan for this pavilion, and we'll change things up every year, but it's definitely going to become a staple of the show, and we'll just keep building and building it as we go forward.
How did you get into this space? Why are you the main man behind it?
So I started many years ago volunteering here at the Royal Agriculture Society, and then through that had an opportunity to work on the district displays many years ago, and then from that have kind of expanded my portfolio, gone through the ranks if you like, and now lead all the education initiatives here at the Royal Show.
Yeah, and you were also an architect, you mentioned as well.
Yeah, so I did my degree many years ago, which has been really great and helpful in terms of the design, because designing exhibitions, layouts, public flow, all those kind of things. Yeah, it's a great degree to have helped with this. So yeah, just another interesting pathway to get involved in ag that's not studying ag or being coming from a farm.
Yeah, cool. And if people are interested to come along to this exhibit themselves and see what we're talking about and actually, you know, design a drone or a tractor, where do they come?
So the easiest way to describe it is it's next to Farm to Food, which is the big pavilion at the top of the hill, and it's in the big marquee that's just next to that. So close to the Yellow Brick Road collection point. So while you're here, pick up a Yellow Brick Road bag and start your journey.
Beautiful. Well, have a great show week and good luck with it all.
Thank you very much.
Rural reporter Kate Forrester speaking to Alaric Korb, the Senior Agricultural Education Coordinator at the Perth Royal Show. 11 minutes to one. And one of the big awards at the show every year has just been announced today. Kate, you have the winner and the runner-up with you now.
So I am currently standing with two women here. One is the winner of the Rural Ambassador for WA and one's the runner-up. I'm going to start with you, Tiff, today. Just introduce yourself for me and tell me really briefly, what have you just won?
Certainly. So I have just won the Rural Ambassador Program in Western Australia. So it's actually a national program, and it's about getting, I suppose, young people in regional Australia the platform to share how important the show movement is, advocate for their communities, advocate for regional Australia. And then I'll go on now to compete at the national finals at ECCA in August next year.
So tell me, Tiff, a little bit about yourself. Where are you from and why do you think you're in this position today?
Yeah, certainly. So I'm from my family's property in Conangoring, and I've always been really...
Which is where?
Oh, Conangoring, yes. So that is located northeast of Perth, a couple of hours out. And I've always been really passionate about the show movement. I think the shows are about celebrating our regions. I love the way they unite the communities. And I think it's a really good showcase for the agricultural industry and a great way to share the industry's stories and connect with so many people. And the Perth Rural especially is the opportunity for a lot of people. They come and they want to learn about where their food comes from. So yeah, there's a lot of farmers in town. They have really grown the agricultural education aspect of the Perth Royal Show, so it's just a really great opportunity for people to engage with agriculture.
Yeah, so to become the Rural Ambassador, what do you have to do?
Certainly. So I think get involved with your local show, and then each local show has the ability to nominate a Rural Ambassador. You'll go on to compete at the zone finals, so I'm the central representative, and then you'll come along here to the Perth Royal Show, and the finalists will compete for the state title. So there were six competitors this year across the state, and actually all women, so that was pretty amazing, but we do need more men, so it's for anyone between the ages of 18 and 30.
And you, to be honest, Tiff, you come up in a lot of different areas for me in my job in rural, because you've got your fingers in a lot of pies. You've, from memory, you've spent a bit of time like on the export boats. You've also done a lot of work with Keep the Sheep. Tell me a bit about that background.
Yes, certainly. So I am an accredited live export stock person. So I sail on the ships predominantly with sheep from Western Australia to the Middle East. And the Keep the Sheep was incredible in the way that it united the industry. And I think it is a really good example of what happens when the industry steps up and takes ownership of their story. We should have done it 5 years ago. We should have done it 10 years ago. But we need to continue to do the work that we did with Keep the Sheep. There were so many growers who were brave. They were scared to tell their stories. They were scared to put their faces in front of the cameras. But look what's happened when we did. It wasn't the outcome we wanted, but for the first time in a really, really long time, the industry took ownership over something they were really proud of, took ownership of their stories, weren't afraid to share their stories and their passion for the industry. And despite the outcome, we actually had a huge demographic of people who had nothing to do with the agricultural industry reach out to us with their questions. And we were able to engage with them in a way that was really polite. Like, okay, what are you concerned about within the industry? We're here to answer your questions. So we did a lot of work that should have done a long time ago, but we need to keep the momentum going.
What's your take on the news about no boats going out of Freo for the next couple of months?
Yeah, obviously it's disappointing. It's still an important part of the industry, and we obviously want to see that continue until the phase out. And I hope that changes. And I love sailing. I love sailing. It's my escape from anything. I go out to sea. I've just got sheep to look after. No signals. On a personal note, I don't know. I'll have to find a new way to not talk to anyone other than sheep.
Because does that mean that you were out of work?
Correct. So I'm a contractor, so I contract myself out to live export companies. And yeah, we're already seeing the flow and effect of the ban being announced. So I want to continue to share the message that it is having an effect on rural communities already.
And is it something that you could use your platform as Rural Ambassador to share what you've just told me there?
Yes, certainly. Certainly. I think absolutely the effects of the phase out will have on WA, and is already having. But also I really, really want to stress that I want to use this platform. The work we did with Keep the Sheep was incredible. The way growers stepped up, the way anyone within the industry stepped up
to share their story. We need to continue doing that. We are so reactive as an industry rather than proactive. So, you know, don't be afraid. Start your social media account. Start a column in your local paper. You know, there are so many ways. Come and volunteer here at the Perth Royal Show. They actually have one day a week they showcase a family farm, and there's the ability for the general public to come and ask questions to a farmer directly. And despite what we say, we could go on and on and on about the city-country divide. People are curious about where their food comes from, and they want to meet these real farmers. They want to meet the salt of the earth people who are growing their food. So get involved. Step out of your comfort zones. We cannot continue to be reactive as an industry. We have to be proactive. So that would be my key message.
So I think it's a good time now to bring in the runner-up for the Rural Ambassador Award. If you could just introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about yourself.
Nell Eastoff. I'm from Una. I'm a farmer out there, like so about 80 k's northeast of Jero. And just really passionate about agriculture and really involved in like the grower groups, and especially just trying to bring amenities and resources to the regions rather than it all being in a central location. So because a lot of the time when we're having, you know, variable seasons, especially in the lower rainfall zones, like we're just not getting as many amenities as regions a lot closer to Perth definitely.
When you say amenities and resources, what are you talking about?
Things like your mental health trucks, all that sort of stuff. Like a lot of them are still based down here. Some, we had one based in Geraldton. There's another one heading up there now. But yeah, most of our things still come from Perth, that sort of stuff.
So what are you wanting to do with your position this year then, Nell?
Well, I was looking at more volunteer burnout in those small communities, just with the population decline. We're just struggling to, we just don't have enough people to sustain our communities. So you're ending up with the same people running your tennis club, your golf club, your show and your grower group. And it's just not sustainable for that one person to run that.
So what's your solution?
I've been looking into the companies that offer the volunteer days. So certain companies offer 2 volunteer days just off the bat. And I wanted to make a registry of all the companies that do that. So when you do have your show and you need help setting up, you can contact those companies, or as a grower group, like we can get, you know, ag companies on board and they help us, and those sort of things to see, yeah, get more people around.
Oh my gosh, you're gonna have a busy year ahead of you, I feel.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, it's a pretty good role too, like come to Perth and get to meet a lot of people that normally wouldn't be associated with. We definitely live in a bit of a bubble in the Midwest. So it's really cool to come to Perth and, yeah, meet a whole new range of people.
Just quickly before I let you go, since you are down in Perth, how's your season out that way at the moment?
We're having a really good year. We're heading into harvest soon. So, yeah, our crops look amazing. So hopefully it pulls off and, yeah, we can get it in the bin.
Yeah. What about you, Tiff?
Yeah, no, same again. I think we're happy with the season. Pop will be listening right now, so he'll be annoyed at me for commenting on the crops because I haven't spent much time looking at them this year. But no, we're also happy, so it'll hopefully be a good harvest. He's hoping.
Yeah, well, guys, really, really congratulations for everything that you've got ahead of you for the next 12 months. I am looking and there's a lineup of people already waiting to talk to you, so I'm going to let you go. But thanks so much for your time on the ABC Country Hour.
No, thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Kate.
Rural reporter Kate Forrester catching up with the 2025 WA Rural Ambassador, Tiffany Davey from Gemelling, who was recognised for her community involvement and advocacy for ag education, and also the runner-up, Nell Eastoff from Una in the Midwest. And the Royal Agricultural Society said that Tiffany is a really strong advocate for the agricultural industry and has devoted her professional life to regional WA, both through her work in her pastured-raised business, Berrikey Eggs, and in the exhibition poultry space. And in her spare time, she volunteers in her local Country Women's Association, the ANZAC Committee, and is also a member of Young Livestock Exporters Network and Advocate WA. So well done to both Tiff and to Nell and their awards at this year's 2025 WA Rural Ambassador. A couple of minutes away from the news at 1 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Annie Guest. Join me for The World Today. We look at why Optus customers are facing more problems calling 000. The latest outage comes just ahead of a government meeting with its parent company. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu prepares to meet US President Donald Trump at the White House as bombing continues in Gaza. And as Australia's housing crisis continues, could a 3D printer called Charlotte possibly make a house in a day?
A minute away from the news at one, followed by The World Today. Just wanted to let you know, if you're in the grains industry, this might be something you want to head along to tomorrow. The Pastoralists and Graziers Association is hosting a grains industry forum. It's going to be held at York, so 100 kilometres east of Perth. It's on tomorrow afternoon, and it's going to be held at the town's recreation centre. There's a number of guest speakers there to talk about a range of things. There's a look at CBH's grain transport logistics with harvest just about to start, the GRDC levies, the state of local roads, and also the state's new firearms legislation. So get there at 2 o'clock tomorrow for a 2:30 start if you're in the grains industry and want to head along to that forum. Time for the news on the ABC, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.